We're discussing pandemic fatigue and the psychology of battling a pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams told NPR last month that pandemic fatigue is largely to blame for the recent surge.
The virus hit different places of the country at different points. And so you've had people who've been doing these things since February, March, April, but they didn't really start to see the wave until later on, and they're just plain tired.
Do you find yourself taking more health risks now? Is it difficult to stay away from loved ones or continually mask up? It's 800-642-1234. Jay Maddock is a professor in the School of Public Health at Texas A&M University. Jay, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. Great to be here.
Well, where do you see pandemic fatigue rearing up? How do you define it?
So really, pandemic fatigue is you know, the fact that people are just tired of the precautionary measures, you know, wearing masks wherever they go, even washing their hands. But the biggest, I think, is being socially isolated from other people. That's the hardest thing to do over a long term. And you know, when this came out back in March, you know, our university, our kids were on spring break, and we added 3 days to spring break, hoping that that would be enough time to get through the pandemic. And I think that's one of the hardest things, right? Is how long is this thing going to last? And I think, you know, it's now that we're months and months and months into it, it's hard to keep those behaviors up over long term.
Yeah. What are public health experts fighting against here? Because they can offer all the encouragement in the world that a vaccine is coming, that if you just do X, things will be better. But do people really believe it?
You know, I think they do. But I think, you know, if you look at the timeline of a vaccine, you know, we're going to hopefully be getting shots in arms by the end of the year. But for most of the healthy population, it's going to be sometime in March, April, maybe even May before a shot's available. And so you're still looking at another 6 months. And we're in this kind of perfect storm time, where we're going through the holidays. And so we just went through Thanksgiving, which, you know, looks like it led to a surge in cases. We're coming up on Christmas, Hanukkah, et cetera. And then, of course, in places like Wisconsin, the weather is so cold that you have to be inside. You know, in the summer, okay, we could get through the holidays because you could have get-togethers outside. Mm-hmm. And now we're the place where, like, even safe gathering is hard to figure out how to do it.
Yeah, you know, temperatures will get cold. It's been pretty mild so far, but you're right. I mean, things will have to move inside, and then people will have to start making maybe trickier decisions about how much risk they're going to take. Does this really come down to a matter of, you know, how much risk one will take?
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is, and I think it's, you know, it's trying to figure out what level of risk is acceptable. And I think people don't understand the virus as well as they should, and so they don't realize what's risky. And so what I tell people is, look, if you're indoors without a mask, that is one of the most risky situations you can be in. And so where it might seem safe to go to a restaurant or a bar, those are risky situations because almost everybody has their mask off. You're indoors. You know, and then especially if alcohol is involved, people forget the social distancing fairly easily. So those are some of the riskiest situations you can get involved in.
We have Jay Maddock. He is a psychologist at Texas A&M University. We're looking at the implications of pandemic fatigue. Where do you see it? Do you think pandemic fatigue is real? Are you someone who's experienced it or currently dealing with it? What do you think is contributing to these thoughts and feelings? 800-642-1234 to join in. Jerry is joining us from Waukesha. Hi, Jerry. What are your thoughts on pandemic fatigue?
Well, I can agree 100% about pandemic fatigue. I've been dealing with it like everybody else since March. My mother lives in an independent living community that I had to get an attorney to help me be able to help her with her shower once a week. So it's a dilemma. But here's my comment or answer to your comment or question about Joe Biden and 100 days of mask wearing. I will elect, and I would ask that everybody do it under these conditions. If Joe Biden's going to go to all the governors and tell them to reopen the businesses and put in the safety measures that they can operate at 50% or better, I will wear a mask 24/7.
All right. So Jerry is seeing some trade-offs here for mask wearing, and mask wearing has become such a contentious issue, Jay. What do you see there?
You know, I love Jerry's point, because this is something that I've been arguing for quite a while, is that the more that people wear masks, the more that we can open up the economy. And I think, you know, we put them kind of in this whole thing of, you know, you either do your pandemic preparedness or you don't. And the thing is that, you know, masks are one of the best ways. Obviously, we need social distancing and stuff, but businesses are going to keep getting closed if people don't wear their masks. And you're seeing this now in California and other parts of the country, where if people don't follow the guidelines, we have surges and the businesses end up closed. And so I think we need to really say, let's be as safe as we possibly can. And then with those businesses, let's look at how, if we're in those settings, we can run that safely. Now, of course, the eating and drinking is tough, because you can't wear a mask and eat and drink at the same time, right?
When you say, how do we stay safe as we possibly can, I want to look at college campuses for a moment. You're at Texas A&M, a very large institution. Classes are in person. How are students and faculty feeling about the pandemic at this time?
Okay, it's actually funny. So we taught the fall semester in a hybrid model. And so my class, I had 50 seniors in my class. And we prepared over the summer, and they gave me a classroom that sat 150, but it was also available via Zoom. And on the first week of class, I had 13 students in my class. And by the last 3 weeks, I had one student who showed up. Mm. And so our students are deciding to take classes virtually, even though we're offering it. I think if it's not a laboratory or something, most of them are not showing up. So I felt very safe as a professor. We had almost zero transmission from students to faculty. Mostly what we saw was students gathering socially at parties and stuff, and that's where we saw the spread of the virus.
How do students feel about mask wearing?
You know, at Texas A&M, which, you know, has a long history as a military university,
yeah.
Very well. I think it depends where you are with that, but we did not have any issues with that. They did really, really well.
How have you approached testing for the virus?
Sure. So Texas A&M offered free testing for every student, faculty, and staff member. It was widely available throughout the campus at a variety of just cheek swab areas. You can do it very quickly. We did random sampling to look at baseline levels in the population, and that kind of helped us in just knowing, you know, where we were seeing hotspots or when we were seeing them. And then did a major thing. We changed our schedule to finish up before Thanksgiving. And so the week before Thanksgiving, we really, really encouraged everybody to get tested before they went home, knowing that a lot of those college kids, if they have it, you know, they're circulating it in kind of the young, healthy population, but they're going home right before Thanksgiving. So we tried to make sure, and we had a huge surge in the number of students that took the test, which was great.
Oh, so they heeded that. They actually, you saw an uptick in testing.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't, I mean, it was not universal, but certainly the students really took the message to heart. We really said, you know, we're sending you home before Thanksgiving because we don't want you to go home and come back. But, you know, we don't want you to bring the virus back to your, you know, your grandparents and other vulnerable people. And so, yeah, we saw, I mean, it was not obviously universal, but it was thousands and thousands of students got tested.
We're discussing pandemic fatigue with public health professor Jay Maddock of Texas A&M University, where he researches human behaviors. What is most stressful to you now? Do you have ways to cope? What self-care strategies are you taking up in the pandemic? Can you keep them up when the going gets tough? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Jay Maddock here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the effects of pandemic fatigue on our nation, on our community, on our family. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. As winter sets in and we're in the thick of the holidays, it's incredibly tempting to want to spend time indoors with family and friends. Exhaustion and impatience have set in. Public health officials say this is a real challenge. Do you think pandemic fatigue is real? Are you beyond sick and tired of the COVID crisis? Have you found ways to cope with your exasperation? What works? Join in 800-642-1234. Jay Madoc is a professor in the School of Public Health at Texas A&M, and he's with us for the hour. Jay, we heard from Matt in Wausau email to say that President Trump has been having rallies around the country, including in Georgia recently, where very few people wear masks. How does this kind of event add to or impact pandemic fatigue?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So from a psychological standpoint, one of the biggest factors we look at is social norms. And so what's acceptable behavior and what's not acceptable behavior? And I think when we have, you know, a person in a prominent position who is not following the guidelines, not following his own government's expertise and performing that, it says to a lot of people that follow him, this isn't serious. We don't need to believe in this. Everybody else is doing this. So why do we have to follow this? So it's really actually a very dangerous public health message to not be, you know, following the guidelines. And so it has led to certain spreads, obviously, throughout the country and throughout his administration, where you see people that follow those, you know, don't follow the guidelines, and Rudy Giuliani being the last one to contract COVID.
So when you look at our perception of the virus, fewer Americans say they fear COVID compared to how they felt in the spring. Why is this happening?
Yeah, so, you know, there's two big factors psychologically we look at called perceived susceptibility and perceived severity. And so perceived susceptibility is how likely is it that I'm going to get this? And perceived severity is if I get it, how bad is it going to be? And so I think when we kind of had lockdowns in March and April, we didn't know what was going to happen, right? And so when you say, you know, how likely am I to get this? We didn't know if it was going to be 5% of the population, 10%, 20%. And even though we've had millions of cases, it's still, you know, only a couple of percent of Americans have had COVID. And so most Americans still have not had COVID. And so when you look around, you look at your friends, you say, wow, not as many people have gotten it. Also, the death rate has declined. I mean, what was originally coming out of China, the death rate was 6%, and now it's, you know, it's around 2%. And so it seems like it's not as terrible if you get it. It is, you still get really, really sick, and I think that's the important thing to know, is even if you're not at a high-risk category and you don't die from this, it's really a miserable virus to have. And so I think the public health messaging around this is needs to be that you are, you know, if you don't follow the guidelines, you are likely to get it. And if you get it, it's likely to be really bad, even if it's not fatal.
So if you then find out that you know someone close to you who has COVID, how might your perceptions change and your behaviors change?
And that's typically what it is that when you know somebody, that's when you decide to change your behavior. And especially when you know, but you can look at them, even if it's somebody close to you. How did they contract COVID? Were they one of your safe friends or were they one of your dangerous friends? And so, you know, I've had this where I've known people, but it's like, oh, they were going out to restaurants, you know, every week, and I'm not surprised they got it. And so it didn't change my perception.
Oh, so we even categorize their risk level and then apply it to our own life.
Yeah, I mean, we all have those friends that, you know, are just like, whatever, I'm not going to wear a mask, or I'm going to go out to eat, or, you know, I'm going to the bars, and they end up getting COVID. And then you go, well, that's not me, right? I'm much safer. So we put ourselves on kind of a level of how safe we are. And then we have friends that are either more safe or more risky than we are. And so if it's one of the more safe friends, that can change our behavior. But if it's one of the more risky, it's probably not going to.
We're talking with Jay Madoc, who is a professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at the School of Public Health at Texas A&M. And we're delving into pandemic fatigue this hour, where we see it, what to do about it, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Elaine, who's joining us from Fort Atkinson. Hi, Elaine. What would you like to say about pandemic fatigue?
Well, I think part of it is the words that we use. And I mean that in the respect that we can be social. We just need to be physically distanced. Mm. And maybe if we started saying we have to maintain physical distance, we could change the mindset that we can still be social. We just need to be physically distanced.
Elaine, thank you for that, saying, you know, social distancing, the term itself is a misnomer, Jay.
Elaine, you are right on. And I've had that conversation with several of my colleagues that we should call it physical distancing, not social distancing. And I think one of the biggest problems with pandemic fatigue has been that people have socially distanced themselves from other people. And that feeling of loneliness and isolation is terrible for our mental health. And I think a lot of people are trying to combat that. And so it's trying to figure out how you can be socially connected while remaining physically distant. So outstanding point.
The CDC has come out and is now recommending people with COVID quarantine for 7 to 10 days rather than the 14 days that was originally prescribed. How might this help or hurt our perception of the virus?
You know, I think on one side, it makes it easier to quarantine if you've been exposed, because 14 days is a long time. And it's pretty much showing that, you know, by the end of 10 days, if you're not showing symptoms, you're probably fine. But it also can reduce our thought of the severity, right? Oh, it's only a 10-day virus. And so, you know, it can go backwards and forth. But, I think the really big thing here is that, you know, yes, it's a little bit shorter, but it shouldn't change your behavior. You know, I'm only 11 days out from Christmas, so I'm going to go out and, you know, do this and do that, because 10 days from now, I'll be fine to go see my family. That's really not a good way to approach this.
Let's bring in Mary in Pewaukee. Hi, Mary. What would you like to add this morning?
Hi. I just would like to add that wearing a mask is a very small sacrifice for all of us to do out of respect for ourselves and each other, of people outside of our family. So, I mean, you don't have to wear a mask 24/7. We're in the house most of the time, with or without the people that we live with. So I will be one of the first people once the vaccine is offered to me. My husband is a nurse, so he's going to be on the front lines and be required to get the vaccine. And if we don't abide by the science, the doctors, and what the CDC is telling us with all the physical distancing, the hand washing, and the wearing of the masks in public, then we are going to be wearing masks and doing all these things for the rest of our lives. So for a short period of time, suck it up.
Mary, thank you. Mary saying mask wearing is a very small sacrifice when you look big picture, Jay.
Yeah, Mary is right on. I mean, it's not a lot to ask to wear a mask. As a professor, I lectured for an hour and a half twice a week wearing a mask. And, you know, it's not that hard. You know, it's something that's easy enough to do. You can do it for a long time. And, it's really, you know, physicians and surgeons are wearing that mask, you know, the entire day. We can certainly do that. It's a small sacrifice. And she's right, because with the vaccine, you know, it's an issue is until we get herd immunity, coronavirus is going to circulate throughout the community. And so, the faster that we can kind of tamp down the virus, the more that we can go back to living lives the way we used to pre-pandemic.
I want to fold in here vaccine safety and uptake of vaccine, whether people will take it. How difficult might that be to change people's minds who don't believe that it is safe?
You know, Kate, what I've seen, which is interesting, is you certainly in this country have had a large group of people that are anti-vaccination. And I wouldn't really worry about them at this point, because I think they're going to be very hard to change. What I've seen is the kind of vast middle ground of people that typically get vaccines, got their flu shot this year, that are concerned about the safety of the COVID-19 vaccine. And so I think that's the people that we work with on this. And I think we really, increasing data, increasing people that are respected, that are taking the vaccine. So in countries like China, with their vaccine, the first people to get the vaccine was the leadership. And I think that was really important from a leadership perspective. I think for President Biden to publicly get vaccinated when he comes into office will be a really important step to say, hey, we're not afraid of this. We know that there's efficacy data and this is safe. And then really being transparent when there is, there are going to be people that have negative effects of getting a vaccine. It happens with every single vaccine, but being transparent with that data, I think, is important, that no one's trying to hide something, because that one or two cases circulate, we saw it during the testing of people getting, oh, geez, you know, somebody had an adverse event. Well, that happens, but let's be transparent. Let's make people know that that does happen. But what percentage does it actually happen in?
And so you're saying that just focus on the groups who have more tendency to want to take a vaccine and get them vaccinated first, and then look to people who may not, you know, may believe the pandemic is a hoax, for instance.
Yeah. I mean, you know, first of all, we're not going to have enough vaccine to go around anyway, you know, in the next 4 or 5 months. And so, you know, I think getting the people that traditionally will get vaccines, if somebody's not going to get their measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine because they believe it causes autism, trying to get them a COVID-19 vaccine is probably going to be a tough sell, right? And so, you know, we have to go through the vast majority. If we can get to that 70% plus vaccination rate, then we'll achieve herd immunity. And so, you know, that's the number one goal. And I think getting some of the harder people is something we can worry out later in 2021.
We'll pick this up with Jay Maddock after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. I just want to say a quick thank you. Thank you for donating during our year-end member drive. Support from people like Angela in Marshfield makes the important conversations you value on the Ideas Network possible. If you missed the drive, there's still time to join in with your donation and ask for your Reach Out and Read thank you gift at WPR.org. Your 2020 year-end gift ensures a strong future for the WPR programs you love. Right now, we're talking about pandemic fatigue, how to identify it, what to do about it to prevent putting ourselves or our loved ones at greater risk. Governor Evers, in his pandemic briefing with reporters Thursday, urged Wisconsinites to hang in there.
Let's get through these next few months together with empathy, hope, and resilience. By looking out for our neighbors, wearing our masks, and staying home as much as possible.
Are you following the sentiment? Are you short on patience? Is it possible to be a good neighbor and friend? It's 800-642-1234. We have psychologist and School of Public Health professor at Texas A&M, Jay Maddock, with us. Let's take another call now. Emma is with us from Madison. Hi, Emma. What would you like to say?
Well, I have two things to say. One is that COVID is real. I know several people who have had it. One person's dead. One person had it affected his brain, and now he's having trouble using his phone, and he's hallucinating a lot. Two people have had, they have issues breathing now that they didn't have before. So there definitely are consequences, and it's really sobering. The other thing is I have a relative who works at a care facility, and it's for people who are older, and she has become really attached to people there. Well, someone didn't wear a mask. Anyway, COVID went through the facility. She got it and she couldn't work for 10 days. But during that time, 5 people died. Mm. And they were people she was really close to and couldn't say goodbye to. So I think we have to think about those healthcare workers who are out there on the front lines and what we're doing to them. I think we need some empathy and sympathy and stop thinking about ourselves so much. And you know, if you also think about what people have gone through in the past and survived for years, what about, you know, the depression? What about, you know, and I'm, you know, not saying that this has been affecting people too, who are, you know, losing their housing and they don't have enough food to eat and that sort of thing. I mean, it just, you know, I think that, in a lot of ways, we're wimps. But I think the things that I've been doing to I've been trying to change things up and, you know, go for walks and choose new areas to go for walks. I surprised one of my friends by putting some Christmas decorations in her front yard, which in the end she really appreciated because she just didn't feel like she felt like doing it, but she really wanted that to happen. You know, doing things for others, little surprises like that, I think.
Emma, how are you holding up?
I think most days I do okay.
Yeah, yeah. Jay, what would you like to say to Emma?
Emma, wonderful points. I think so many. I think that the long haul piece of COVID is something that I think is really important. I had a friend who is in her mid-30s and is healthy, and she contracted COVID in July and is still experiencing symptoms, hair loss and energy issues, thyroid issues. So even in young, healthy people, there are can be really, really severe consequences of COVID. And, you know, exactly what you said with our college students, that was the biggest thing, is so many of the college students say, you know what, I'm 21, I'm healthy, I'm going to get this, and
I'm invincible.
Yeah. And then what we say is, yeah, but you get that, but then you go work at a restaurant or you go work somewhere else and you spread it to a bunch of other people who are not. And so that, you know, that idea of who are you spreading it to and not. And then I love your idea of kind of surprising other people. I think looking for ways that we can be social within this is important, ways that we can do things that we might not normally have done. My other research area is in health and nature and exposure to natural environments. So I love your idea of going for a walk.
And changing her route, like mixing it up.
Exactly, exactly. So we tell people, go find new natural areas. Go, you know, with Christmas lights out around the country, this is a great time to go out and see things that you might not normally have had time and experience it from, you know, a distance perspective and really enjoy the season. I've noticed the migration of birds and other things that I was normally so busy, I didn't have the time to actually go and experience. So it's actually a great time to kind of experience the natural environment also.
One of the things Emma brought up is saying goodbye and the inability to do that, you know, in the situation Emma had in the long-term care facility. How do you deal with those feelings when the end isn't how you planned it in any way?
Yeah, you know, that is such, I think it's one of the toughest things. And I think that, you know, death is never something that we plan for or expect. And sometimes it's very sudden and sometimes it's like this where it has to be distance. And I think we do the best that we can. We remember the people for the way that we lived with them. And we know that, yes, we'd love to be there, but at the same time, we could be the one that goes and infects other people in, say, a long-term care facility or a hospital. And so it is a sacrifice. I think that is something that we need to go through. But it can be really hard. And so I think that's, you know, the best thing that we can do is prevention, to try to make sure that we don't have those. And I think the hope is that in the next month that the majority of people in long-term care facilities will be vaccinated, so that hopefully, you know, all these deaths that we've seen are going to drop really, really dramatically in the next couple of months.
We have Jay Maddock with us. He's a public health researcher at Texas A&M University. He's describing pandemic fatigue, the implications, where we go from here. How have you found ways to cope in these times? What has worked? What isn't working? Join in at 800-642-1234. Martha is with us from Menominee. Hi, Martha.
Hi, good morning. Say, my question is kind of more general, but what I'd like to know is, you know, when I grew up, I was raised by a Wisconsin little German Lutheran grandmother. She went without nylon stockings and sugar and gas rations. You know, for a long time, people sacrificed to fight a common enemy. What changed? Could you ask the professor, what changed? Why did we turn into a nation of wimps where we can't put a little cloth thing over our face for 3 minutes to run into a Quick Trip? And why would these businesses cater to that minority of people that won't wear one when the majority of their customers, you know, don't want to go in a store when somebody can't put on a mask? It's so simple. And if I don't buy this business that, oh, I can't breathe. I know a respiratory therapist that said, if you can't breathe through your mask, you're wearing the wrong mask.
Martha, thank you. Are we less likely to make these difficult choices now, or are we less likely, Jay, to not comply?
Well, I think sadly we've had a failure of leadership in this country. I think if the message from the beginning was, look, I don't care about your politics. I don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican. We need to do this for the health of America. And we need to come together and we need to sacrifice. If you look at World War II, that was the message, right? It was have victory gardens. It was do things to make sure that our soldiers were supported as much as possible in overcoming, the war. And I think we have not had that kind of call to Americans to say, look, this is us. We need to sacrifice. We need to be in this together. I think that's where it starts, you know, in a lot of ways is it starts with the leadership and it starts with saying the clear messaging on this. You're doing this for your country. You're not doing this for yourself. You're doing this for everybody. And if we get in this together, we're going to make a big difference. And so I think that's it. I think we haven't asked Americans to sacrifice in a long time. And I think that, that call, I mean, one thing that I've pushed, back in 2008 when we had the recession is you look back in the Great Depression and we had the Works Project Administration, right, where we said we're going to get Americans back to work, but, we're going to give them jobs and do these great public works projects, which you still see if you go to parks and other places throughout the country today. And instead we send people checks. And so, it's like, gosh, I wish we could get back to, let's do this in a way that we really promote, promote sacrificing for our country and to give back. But I think we've lost that message a bit.
Let's look for a moment at social media, at also news organizations focusing on COVID day in and day out. How could this influence the news media and your views affect how you approach the COVID crisis?
Yeah, Kate, it's really interesting. People more and more are in these media bubbles that they were not in before. We have because, if you look even 30 years ago, we were, mostly just major networks and the like. And now we have such narrowcasting that you can really get the news that says what you want to hear, and which is unfortunate because people have these cognitive biases where they want to look and say, I want the person to say what I want them to hear. And I can find a news station that's going to tell me no matter what I believe that. And that's I think that's helped divide America. And I think it's helped spread the recommendations on this pandemic so that people believe all sorts of different things, either that it doesn't exist to, oh my gosh, I need to stay at home and not move. And so the media bubbles have been reinforcing the beliefs that people have had.
Jay Maddock is with us as we look at pandemic fatigue. He's an expert on social behavior at Texas A&M. Are you a psychologist or social worker? What's your perspective on pandemic fatigue? What have you told your patients, your clients, or students, for that matter, on how to deal with it? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Jay Maddock here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with public health researcher and psychologist Jay Maddock, who studies human behaviors. He's explaining what we can do when pandemic fatigue sets in. Let's go to Jerry now in Brookfield. Jerry, what can you add here?
Hi, good morning. Just wanted to comment that through the pandemic, we've kind of seen between my wife and I this from kind of two different perspectives. Since about mid to late April, my schedule's kind of returned to normal. I work full time and then part time as a firefighter and EMT in the evenings. And aside from wearing a mask in stores and a little more hand washing, and a few things at the fire department, things really haven't changed in my life, work life so much. But for my wife, who's a stay at home mom and homeschooler, her and the kids haven't been able to do as many of the things that they normally do, going on group outings and other stuff. So for us, it's been a little bit of a struggle. And we've had a couple families that we're close to that are kind of within our little bubble, I guess is the term these days, that we see periodically, but far enough apart that if somebody were exposed, we can stop, that there. The other thing my wife has found somewhat therapeutic was a motorcycle I got her last September. That's kind of been her outlet. So, you know, she's still a new rider, but she enjoys every week or 2 weeks. Even yesterday, she was out just getting some time out of the house to get outside and
go on a ride
and kind of tune everything out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Jerry, thank you for bringing your home life situation. And Jay, you know, Jerry has been able to pretty much stay on track in how his life unfolds each day, but his spouse is probably feeling way more cooped up. How would you negotiate that?
Yeah, Jerry, great points. I think, you know, everybody is going through the pandemic differently, and it's going to affect a lot of our lives differently. I think especially for our kids in places where the schools are closed and kids are now home, and homeschooling either voluntary or involuntarily, I think has been very different. And it's been, I think, really disruptive for a lot of people. So, you know, I love the example of your wife riding her motorcycle. I think, you know, finding those new outlets where we can be safe, but we can also enjoy new hobbies, activities, things that give us joy in life. And I think that's one of the biggest things is where do we find that break, that respite? You know, maybe it might be moments of solitude if we're with a bunch of people, or it might be moments of, you know, some way to connect. But how do you find joy safely in the pandemic is, I think, one of the biggest things that we should all be asking ourselves right now. And it'll help us get through this pandemic fatigue.
One challenge in the pandemic is taking work home and really never having a clear defining line between what is work life and what is home life. It has become more blurred. What would you say there?
You know, Kate, that's something that exactly happened to me as we moved home in the spring semester. We were remote, and I noticed that my computer would be on all day. I wouldn't turn my computer off, you know, at 5 o'clock. And then every time I get an email, the thing dings. This is driving me insane. And so, you know, I think, you know, the more that we can make our workday look like a normal workday, I think the better. You know, that having the time where we start our workday at, you know, an hour and then finish it and say, you know what, that's it. I'm done for the day. I'm packing stuff up. I'm turning off my computer. The better. And I think it's also keeping the home life out of the work time, because it's easy to say, oh, I need to throw in a load of laundry, or I need to do this, and I need to do that. And then you get to 5 o'clock and you realize, oh, I've only accomplished half of what I wanted to do today because I was doing all these things around the house. And then you keep working into the evening. I think that's when they kind of get blurred. It's really a bad thing. And so having those set hours, I think, is important. And just being able to really turn off and say, you know, I'm done for the day. I'm not going to do anything else. And I don't want to get back to this.
Let's bring in Stephanie now in Madison. Hi, Stephanie. What is your situation? Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to speak to the perspective that, you know, when you are so I work in the field of caregiving, so not in any sort of nursing home or facilitated living, not in, you know, the hospitals or doctors' clinics. And I supervise people who have to go into people's homes who are vulnerable and with disabilities of varying types. And, you know, none of the staff folks, caregivers, are medical professionals. And so as we're seeing the COVID cases increase and rise amongst the staff or the clients, there's a certain type of fatigue where, you know, the supervisor is.
Oh my goodness! And we just lost Stephanie. Are you there, Stephanie? I'm sorry, we just lost you for a moment.
I'm here.
Okay,
I'm here.
All right, sorry. Carry on. Yeah, we lost you. Just a moment.
Okay.
Yeah, you were talking about the people you supervise. They are in-home caregivers without a medical background. Carry on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and so it's hard. So, you know, for the to rally the employees to feel confident with their, you know, what working, there are many people who have thought nothing of it. And then there are many people who are fearful. So keeping my own spirits up, I should say, is hard because I know I'm just as unsure as anyone else. But I also know that this is the work we do and we have to keep on, or else, you know, then more people get sick.
How do you support your employees, especially when they are feeling fragile?
Well, I hate to give this away, but no, I'm kidding. I try very hard to just be empathetic and say thank you and be there when they can't as well. So it's another, you know, and that's the work. The work is to go and be there and, you know, just find solidarity in the work we do, you know, between every level of staffing, because it's breaking down. The staff pool is breaking down. So.
Do your employees see the effects of loneliness on their clients?
Yes, absolutely. Oh my goodness. The mental health effects are varying depending on the person. But, you know, it's just like anyone, really. You have very social people that you're supporting. You have people who, you know, don't really want to even leave. And so, going over with folks who want to be around friends and family and trying to explain sometimes when it's not understood because there may be a cognitive deficit, you know, and trying to find the words to say, hey, you know, yeah, this stinks, or, you know, or whatever however you relate to that person, and try to, you know, laugh it off, or, you know, or listen, or, you know, or be creative when you're there, you know, in various ways.
Yeah. Each situation is unique. Stephanie, thank you for bringing that. Jay, you know, one layer that we haven't talked about here is loneliness.
Yeah. And I think that is one of the biggest issues for pandemic fatigue is people are definitely feeling lonely. I think a lot of people who live alone or are socially isolated before the pandemic are having it much, much worse. And so the biggest thing is, how do we connect folks while remaining safe? And I think, you know, looking at what does that is, as we caller mentioned earlier, you know, physically distancing while being socially connected is the way that we need to go. And I think especially in caregiving, how do we find ways that people can connect, be it through video chat, be it through distance conversations, et cetera. And the people, it's almost, you know, if you see the kind of the two sides of the pandemic preparedness, there's the loose side that we've talked a lot about where people aren't wearing their masks, they're not doing what they're supposed to do. And then there's the tight side on the other where people are overly protecting themselves, where they're really staying in their home, they're not going anywhere. And those are the people I think that were most likely to see things like depression and other effects of social isolation. So, you know, making sure that you're balancing that social connectedness with your safety precautions.
Jay, thank you for joining us.
It was delightful, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Jay Madoc is a professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health, the School of Public Health at Texas A&M University. Just ahead, COVID at the intersection of mass transit in America. What measures are being taken by local governments and the federal government to keep mass transit afloat? 1A looks into that next. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.